morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. The first year of the first African-American president has ebbed and flowed, so by what criteria do we gauge Barack Obama's rookie season? Was George W. Bush so bad that just being the non-Bush is good enough for Obama? Did the American people expect too much from Obama too quickly following a campaign season of stirring rhetoric and high hopes? Well, coming off the disabled list, following a bout with laryngitis to analyze it all, is Dr. Rob McDaniel, Associate Professor of Political Science. Welcome back. It's nice to hear your voice again.
Hi, Jen. It's great to be here.
Let's start with domestic affairs. And within that category, the subcategory of the economy, everyone, even the loyal opposition, admits Obama inherited a major mess. The national unemployment rate was 10% in November. Millions of people are worried they'll be next. Foreclosures and credit cards are still scare words. And yet, the line from many analysts is that it would have been so much more catastrophic without the stimulus package that Obama pushed through the Congress. So is this a case of where you stand is where you sit?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to sum it up. I don't think there's any doubt the stimulus has been extraordinarily effective. Every economist who's looked at this has said that the stimulus bill in particular has saved us from a much deeper recession. And just to give you an example of how bipartisan this is, Mark Zandi, who was he's the chief economist at Moody's and was one of John McCain's top advisors during the 2008 presidential campaign, has recently himself proclaimed the great success of the stimulus. He said that unemployment without the stimulus bill would have been easily over 12% and possibly still heading in a bad direction. He estimated that the stimulus has either saved or created as much as a million jobs, and I think that the CBO, which is a nonpartisan scorer of these kinds of things, has said that it could be even as high as 1.6 million. And for those of us who work in state government, who teach at state universities, we know the practical impact of this. For example, at MTSU, we know that there would have been severe cuts immediately, that there would have been faculty positions lost had it not been for that stimulus.
Which, given MTSU's impact on the local economy, would have been devastating to Murfreesboro and Rutherford County because those unemployed people would not have been able to go out and spend at local merchants.
That's exactly right. It's been an extraordinary success. And again, it was a $787 billion bill. It was an immense achievement for a first year, for an incoming president. It's the kind of thing that history will eventually judge him on. The main question is whether it was big enough. The only, I think, serious issue is whether or not the stimulus has been big enough to really create robust growth. It was clearly strong enough to prevent a slide into a much steeper recession. The question is it going to be enough to really move us into a period of strong growth? It may be that there does need to be a second stimulus, there needs to be a jobs package, something like that, that goes beyond where we are now. But that's not something that we can, it's not something that they can't come back and revisit, obviously. And so, I think that you have to say that the stimulus on its own terms was a fantastic success. Maybe they could have done more, but it's also possible that they politically couldn't have gotten anything more through than what they did. Mm-hmm. And Republicans sometimes like to criticize and say, well, what we should have done is just free spending and had tax cuts. The problems are these, that first of all, it ignores what was in the bill. That stimulus was actually more than a third tax cuts. It was 35% tax cuts. Now, from a stimulus standpoint, tax cuts are not the most effective way to get an economy moving again. It's usually the spending programs that matter more because they contribute more directly to employment and consumption.
You don't feel tax cuts immediately.
That's right. You typically don't. There were a lot of tax cuts in that bill, but those are not the most effective ways to actually run a stimulus. And the other idea, which was a spending freeze, would have been a disastrously horrible idea. I think a lot of people have a common sense notion that when times are tough, your family ought to cut back, which is very reasonable. The problem is you can't apply that same logic to government, Because if the private sector is losing trillions of dollars of spending, then the only way that you can make up for that is if government spends more than it would have otherwise in order to help fill that gap.
This is straight out of the Keynesian playbook,
isn't it?
That's
exactly right. And, you know, this is something in the Keynesian playbook that there's immense consensus on across ideological and partisan divides. It's really just economics 101. And so I think there's no question that they had to increase spending. The question was how much? Did they do enough? Clearly the stimulus has had a positive effect. Maybe it should have had more, but they can always come back and hopefully revisit that.
Speaking of pragmatism, the one quibble I have is I thought that the administration surely would make the bailouts contingent upon stricter conditions from the get-go, like a tougher payback timetable and requiring anyone who gets taxpayer money to kill any and all executive bonuses and golden parachutes from the get-go. I mean, while at the beginning of this crisis, while you have them by the, forgive me, short hairs, at that time, and they've come to you with hat in hand, and you've got the leverage, why not say on the front end, you do it our way, or you get no dough?
Well, I think that there's a strong case to be made for that. Part of the difficulty is this, especially when evaluating Obama on this. This all actually began under the Bush administration. The bailout, the TARP, right?
Yeah, the first bailout was under the tail end of the Bush administration.
That's right. And you know, the Bush administration wasn't sure what to do. They dithered. They moved back and forth. Hank Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary, wasn't really sure how to respond. And initially, when, for example, Lehman Brothers went under, his response was, well, just let them go and see what happens. The problem was, as soon as that happened, the stock market went down even further, and it looked like we were on the verge of a global economic meltdown, the kind of thing that would have made the Great Depression look like a mere blip on the radar screen. And in that moment of crisis, the grown-ups in the room, in the Bush administration, and Hank Paulson, I think, clearly counts in this category, and Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman as well, the grown-ups stood up and said, we've got to do something, we've got to intervene. And what's most important is to get this done quickly, get everybody on board. And that meant that they took a fairly lenient approach. Mm-hmm. Now, Democrats in Congress wanted something a little bit tougher, but Democrats in Congress weren't really running the show. And so there was a limit to how much Democrats could actually get in this. It was a bipartisan effort, the grown-ups in both parties making a decision to do something that in normal circumstances you wouldn't, mm-hmm. in order to bail out the marketplace and prevent this global meltdown.
And, you know, Obama's defense, I do find it rather ironic that the liberals who are willing to praise him for being willing to open the door to discussions with Ahmadinejad and the other bad guys of the world are equally willing to criticize him for being willing to play ball with the Antichrist over at Goldman Sachs.
Well, yeah, and they have been. They have, I think, had a tin ear for the politics of this. They should have been, I think, much tougher in terms of the language that they've used. I think that they should have put more pressure on Wall Street. But, again, part of the problem is that the basic parameters of the bailout were set before they came into office. It's something that happened in late 2008, and so they're working with something that had already been worked out to a great extent before. Now, they can manage that bailout in different ways. They can push for new legislation in Congress that would limit the way that some of the key players on Wall Street operate. And I think that there is, I mean, there right now there are various proposals for legislative reform. And John McCain, of all people, has come out with a call for a return to what's called Glass-Steagall, which was a Great Depression-era bill that had required a separation between commercial and investment banking as a way of protecting, your sort of mom and pop savings accounts from the kind of investment banking that's much higher risk. You know, that was repealed in the late 1990s by the Republican Congress, and I think a lot of people argue that that's one of the major sources of this collapse. And John McCain, who really for the most part over the last year has renounced every shred of moderation and mavericky appeal that he once cultivated, has actually sort of tried to take the lead on this. And, you know, I think that it's the kind of thing that if the Obama administration got behind, you could actually get some bipartisan support in favor of doing, along with a larger package of reforms as well.
For all of the realism and pragmatism that you bring to the argument, he still, does he not, have the political hurdle of explaining to the American people why he's bailing out the same people who got us into this mess in the first place. You don't have to understand the vagaries of Wall Street to chafe under the weight of that irony. How does Obama get beyond that with the electorate?
Well, that's a political problem. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And I don't think that Obama hoped that his first year would be spending defending Wall Street and the investment banker community. He hasn't been defending them per se, but he's tried to take a fairly restrained approach where he, as much as possible, does what he can do to keep Wall Street functioning while encouraging them to open up lending as much as possible. As fragile as the economy is, and it still is in a very fragile state, he doesn't want to, I think, take too big risks with the functioning of Wall Street. And so he has been fairly cautious in this regard. And part of the problem, again, is that, you know, his own Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, was chairman of the Fed in New York when a lot of this happened and is very close to Goldman Sachs, obviously. And so it looks like within his own administration, he's got some mixed loyalties. I think that this is something that you could easily correct next year. Mm-hmm. It's a popular campaign issue. There are ways in which you could frame this as a popular campaign issue. Mm-hmm. Going for regulations, tighter controls on these folks.
Barney Frank is salivating even as we speak.
Well, that's right, and it's a good thing. It's a good issue for a campaign year like 2010. Mm-hmm. But right now, to put too much energy into this would really deflect attention from the things that are more important on the administration's agenda, which are clearly, you know, healthcare and cap and trade. Regulation to deal with global warming.
So take the political hit now and then rev it up in 2010 to explain this in a way to the unemployed, in a way that makes sense to them, so that they can get past their perception of the hypocrisy in order to see the bigger picture.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, what you want to do, you want to be, I think, cautious and relatively mild toward the Wall Street community while the crisis is still going on. But once things start looking a little bit better, and once you've got the heat of a congressional midterm election campaign going on, that's the time to turn up the heat a little bit. Mm. But right now, I think that Obama rightly sees this as a distraction, mm-hmm. to some extent from the more important fight, which is really health care.
You alluded to health care reform. It's gotten caught up in a briar patch in the Congress. He's taking shots from the right, of course, expectedly, for increasing federal government intervention beyond what they would prefer in their comfort zone, and from the left for being, in their view, too conciliatory, too willing to compromise. Jacob Weinberg wrote at Slate.com, "Given the vastness of the enterprise and the political obstacles, passing an imperfect behemoth and improving it later is probably the only way to succeed where his predecessors failed." Is Weinberg right, or is he trying too hard to find a silver lining?
He's exactly right. There was no way that what liberals wanted was going to get through. And part of the problem is this, that Obama has to deal with a different legislative environment than any previous president. And we should say this as a way of starting this, which is that there's probably nothing in American politics harder to do than reform the healthcare system. Almost every president for a century, going back to Teddy Roosevelt, has tried to do something about the state of healthcare in America. And it just hasn't gotten done. I mean, there have been some important reforms along the way. In particular, you think about Lyndon Johnson and Medicaid and Medicare. But this is a huge, huge fight. And it's much tougher now than it was 30, 50, 80 years ago because the insurance company is a much bigger, wealthier interest with more entrenched connections to members of Congress. This is just a phenomenal feat.
And because healthcare is one-sixth of GDP. It wasn't one-sixth of GDP when LBJ was in office.
That's exactly right. It wasn't. And so the political obstacles are huge. On top of all of that, you have a situation in the Senate that is absolutely unprecedented. And it involves, in particular, the use of the filibuster. And we all know, I mean, anybody's had a, you know, smattering of, you know, had an introduction to political science class in college or took civics in high school, knows about the filibuster, and it's a way for a minority party in the Senate to stop legislation that they don't like.
Hell hath no fury like Joe Lieberman scorned.
That's right. But, you know, the lost in this discussion is that the filibuster is, although it's been around for a long time, it was never, ever used. It was the kind of thing that appeared only very rarely. It was, you know, not even a sort of leap year phenomenon.
Most people think of it in connection with Strom Thurmond trying to prevent integration.
Well, that's right. In fact, that when the filibuster begins to emerge as a significant tactic is during the 1950s, when these old racist Southern Democrats like Strom Thurmond started to use the filibuster as a way of trying to slow down civil rights legislation. And so the use of the filibuster begins to creep up a little bit. You see some use of it in the 1950s and 1960s, primarily for pretty repellent purposes. And it steadily grows over the next couple of decades. But what happens in 2007 is really remarkable. In 2007, when Democrats take control of Congress and Republicans become the minority party, they decide to do something completely different, which is to filibuster everything. And so the Congress from 2007 to 2009 tripled the previous record for most filibusters. And the standard Republican line now is that they will filibuster everything all the time. And not only will they filibuster legislation, they will filibuster every procedural vote to even discuss the legislation along the way.
It's like a football team that has nothing in their defensive playbook except a goal line stand.
That's exactly right. And so they're throwing up every possible obstacle. It is a scorched earth tactic. And you know, this is something that we've never really seen before. And you know, the Democrats have technically 60 votes in the Senate, but there are only really 58 Democratic senators. There are two independents who caucus with them, and one of those independents is Joe Lieberman. And for all accounts and purposes, Joe Lieberman for the last couple of years has been voting effectively as a Republican. He's not as right-wing as Republicans are on most issues, but he's really more part of the Republican caucus than he is the Democratic caucus from an ideological standpoint. And on the healthcare debate, for example, in the last couple of weeks, in the last couple of months, Joe Lieberman has flip-flopped on every healthcare position that he's ever maintained, whether it was a public option or a Medicare buy-in. Joe Lieberman has completely flipped his positions from being strong Democratic positions to being fairly strong Republican positions. And so the Democrats don't really have 60 votes. On top of that, you've got Ben Nelson from Nebraska, who's a very conservative Democrat from a staunchly conservative state. And so Democrats really don't have the consistent votes that they need in order to get this through. And what that means is that any legislation involving health care is going to have to get 60 votes. It's insane. It is ridiculous that it works this way. It is a scandal that every major news outlet in America ought to be talking about. They ought to be allowing up and down votes on these things. But it is the reality. And so as a result of that, anything that they get through, they've got to find a way to get it through either Joe Lieberman or Olympia Snowe, the one Republican who looks like she might be willing to deal with Democrats, but only under very difficult circumstances for Democrats. They've got to get one of those votes. And so I don't really see any alternative to what is going on right now from the standpoint of the Obama administration, and Harry Reid is the majority leader in the Senate.
And another thing to point out about the congressional mix, Johnson had an overwhelming Democratic majority during his term in the Congress. He could get anything through. I mean, even if he were not an arm twister, that he definitely was, he lived up to that reputation.
Right. And it was tough on Johnson, but I mean, Johnson did have overwhelming Democratic majorities. But we should say Obama does too. Obama won in a huge landslide. He won by 7 points, 53 to 46 in the popular vote. The margin obviously much bigger if you look at the Electoral College. He brought in huge majorities in both House and Senate. It's one of the largest majorities that either party has had in decades. And yet the filibuster changes that game. This very unprecedented use of the filibuster means that Obama, even with a huge majority, even with the American people having given him a huge mandate, he's got to deal with a broken down legislative process in ways that LBJ never did.
Okay, so why aren't the cable chat shows going into all of this explanation? Is it because it's procedural and they're afraid people will tune out? Or is it just the fact that it will ever be thus because the people in charge of the process and changing the rules for the process are the very people who are using this process to their benefit?
That's exactly right. The procedural issues don't make good cable news, and when cable news depends upon ratings, the last thing you want to do is bog things down in a difficult procedural debate. Now, part of this is the Democrats' fault. The Democrats should have been waging war on this. They should have been going public with this argument, doing everything they could to dramatize this issue.
Why did they go on recess in August and allow all of these public forums to occur, at which there was all of this vociferous wrangling and hyperbolic rhetoric going on?
Well, I don't think that was necessarily a bad idea. I mean, they traditionally go on recess in August. And to be blunt about it, members of Congress ought to have to face their constituents, even when their constituents are angry and impolite, and even when a lot of the people who they're going to be facing have arguments that don't make a lot of sense. That's simply the job. And so I don't think that the fact that the August recess took place was much of a problem. And frankly, I don't even think it hurt the Democrats. If you actually look at what happened to polling, the support for Obama's health care plan went up. The longer that August recess went on, and the crazier the objections from the Tea Party protesters became, the stronger support for health care got. And so I don't think it hurt them at all. It was a lot of rancor, and I think that generally cable news in particular misinterpreted what was going on and what the public's reaction to that was, which was that a small, very angry, in some ways unhinged fringe was driving debate in ways that didn't really represent the American public as a whole, but that did so in ways that were so dramatic that it made good TV. But again, they missed the forest for the trees, the media coverage did. But generally, I think that it tended to support the healthcare movement. And Obama came in and gave that speech in front of a joint session of Congress at the end of all that, and really consolidated support, I think, for his healthcare plan. What's happened, I think, since then is that support for healthcare has been relatively consistent. He's got roughly 50% support. It's been consistent across time. But if you look at that 50% support, it's not really just 50-50. Of course, there's a small percentage that doesn't really know. But if you look at the opposition, that opposition isn't all from a conservative direction. It's not all the Tea Party protest. That to this point, about a quarter, maybe as much as a third of the people who are opposed to the health care are people who are opposed to it because they think it's too conservative. They want something more liberal. They want a single-payer system, for example, something more like in Canada. And if you look at the recent numbers on healthcare, where in the last week there's been a spike in opposition, that spike in opposition is all on the left. It's a spike in opposition that's come from liberals who are angry because Joe Lieberman has apparently killed the public option. And so Obama's position is still basically the middle position. The Tea Party crowd has not actually increased its share of American opinion since this summer. In fact, if anything, has probably decreased it a little bit.
It's the liberal bloggers who are going for an all or nothing position.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's where, you know, Obama is losing support. But again, Obama's position is still basically the middle position. If you look at where the median American is, where the average, the ideologically average American is, they're about where Obama is. Now, the public option, for example, is very popular. It has close to 60% support in most of the polls that I've seen. And so one of the ironies on this is that actually, in some ways, the liberal position is a very mainstream position. It is the average median voter position. But I think that, that if healthcare passes, voters are, once they see past all of the smoke and the conflict of the moment, voters are generally going to be happy with that legislation, and they're going to give Obama credit for having gotten it through in the face of enormous obstacles and huge pressure from both the right and the left.
Once the program actually gets implemented and people actually start seeing some of the benefits from it.
That's exactly right. Now, one of the difficulties with the legislation is that some of the key provisions in the legislation are not going to take effect until 2012, 2014,
yeah.
And so it's going to be phased in gradually. Not everything's like that. There are insurance reforms in particular that are going to take effect much earlier than that.
Right.
And so people will see immediate benefits. But I think that long-term, this will greatly contribute to Obama's popularity. But short-term, there's no way away from him taking a hit on this.
As a practical matter, politically, does he have to get something passed before his next State of the Union speech?
Yes. I mean, I think
which would be January, around the 20th or so.
I think that's right. He does need to get this passed as soon as possible. And the reason is this, and Republicans understand this. Delay in politics is a word that means kill.
Not people, Tom Delay, although we could apply it.
Well,
that
that's right. The exterminator from Texas, former Republican majority leader. But no, I mean, delay. When people say, let's delay, let's slow down, what they mean is, let's kill this thing. I don't want to take the politically unpopular position of coming out and saying, let's just kill this thing and let the insurance companies do whatever they want to us. But that's effectively what they mean. And so anybody who knows anything about legislative strategy knows that you've got to get stuff like this done. You've got to get it passed. The sooner the better. Any second that you wait, any second that you delay, is greater chance that nothing will happen and that it will die, and that the American healthcare system, which is fundamentally broken, and which is really a scandal. It's a disastrously bad healthcare system.
It is a tragedy when a human being can lose everything that they own, including their house, just in order to keep grandma alive when she falls and breaks her hip. That's right. Obscene.
And this is not about the poor. This is not about the unemployed. And they're certainly going to be helped by healthcare reform, too. But this is primarily about working class and middle class families, people who just can't afford insurance anymore and who are getting dropped by their employers and who are being put at the mercy, the predatory might of insurance companies who, you know, sell you inflated policies and then can dump you the moment that you actually get sick. It's outrageous. It needs to be fixed. And this legislation, I think, will fix it. It's not going to do everything, but it's going to be a major advance. And so, you know, I think that once the American people figure out what's actually in this, it will generally be a pretty popular sell. And it'll go down as an immense achievement for Obama's first year in office.
This is only part one. We've covered domestic politics, and the next show with Dr. Rob McDaniel will take on Obama's record on foreign policy in his first year. But for now, that's it for this Sunday. Dr. Rob McDaniel, thank you for being with us once again on MTSU on the Record.
Thanks, Jenna. It was great being here.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Loeb. Join us again at this same time, our new time, 8 a.m., next Sunday morning. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're also available on iTunes. Merry Christmas.